new state law will require public universities to create equity plans to support underrepresented students.
It's important that it's individual to each campus because the challenges that students face are different on each campus.
You'll hear from Ginger Ostro with the Board of Higher Education. That's just ahead on Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm Ryan Denham, and you'll hear from Bloomington City Manager, who says they're past the catch-up phase on infrastructure investments. So, what's next?
I mean, honestly, it's a very exciting time for the community to be able to even consider, the possibilities.
Charlie Schlenker talks with Tim Gleason about the upcoming visioning retreat with the City Council, and a new exhibition at the McLean County Arts Center looks back on the life and work of a prominent local artist. Well, stories in a Bloomington Normal News update just ahead. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Sylvia Allen.
I really love putting my hearing aids in the morning and hearing all of the sounds that were always in the background, but they weren't audible to me.
Sylvia's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham, sitting in for Sarah Nardi. The west side of Bloomington will soon have quicker access to marijuana. The city council approved a zoning provision clearing the way for the new cannabis sales outlet. In this interview with Charlie Schlenker, Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason says he's not sure what will constitute market saturation.
I'm not sure. You know, I think the business community would decide that. I know that this is the city of Bloomington's second dispensary. We were allowed to at the onset of this, and this will now be number two.
You're anticipating revenue of up to $300,000 a year from this extra one. What would you use that on?
Well, I'll take this down a different direction real quick, just on revenues in general. You know, I'm taking council into a retreat in September. We've had a lot of conversations, you know, when we talk about the elected officials' vision for the community. I think we're beyond the catch-up part on infrastructure, or at least have addressed that, but then actually do more. And then the investment in some of the amenities for the community, all of these cost. And when we look at our revenues and some of the new revenue streams, and the cannabis revenue stream is one that you mentioned, that it's not necessarily tied to anything, and not suggesting that it should be, but it's in that larger bucket, you know, that I would call revenue for investment in the community. So I'm looking for direction coming out of that council retreat in September, where council comes with all their ideas, and I try to figure out with staff a way to pay for it all. I mean, honestly, it's a very exciting time for the community to be able to even consider, the possibilities.
Some of the council members expressed a little bit of frustration before the vote on the cannabis dispensary that they didn't feel they were given an opportunity to speak on the issue. What are the constraints, and is there a way for any future decisions to get them feeling like they do have input?
This one played out a little bit differently than what I would have liked. It has nothing to do with the opinions on the topic, but just the order of things. The packet came out on Thursday, got a question from one of the council members, started responding to a question late morning. And then I think we're pushing the last email to that council member that I shared with all the council members, because I felt it might be relevant to the conversation that evening, but pushing out that last email at like 5:15. And they had a township meeting at 5:30. And then some of the questions were asked of myself and primarily Corporation Council on the possibilities. Originally, we walked into the meeting thinking that this is a zoning matter. And truly, the only options for council are to vote yes or no. I cannot introduce any new information or a cross-examination of the representative that, you know, volunteered to even be there and opened himself up in this case to some of the line of questioning, but found a piece that had never been used by Corporation Counsel Jeff Juergens that does allow counsel to vote during an open item to ask additional questions, not necessarily to introduce new information, but to ask additional questions about the item. Now, shift gears a little bit. While council members can't go to a zoning public hearing and be an active participant in that, they definitely are noticed on the different items that are coming before zoning. So they would have been aware of that. And also boards and commissions work in such a manner that they can voice their opinions and beliefs to those that are representing the council on the different boards and commissions. So zoning would have been no different.
So there are avenues for them to take advantage of things.
Yes, there mm-hmm. are other avenues.
The PSCRB, Public Safety Community Relations Board, had Ashley Farmer said recently at the quarterly meeting that they need to better share the story of that board. How should the city do that?
I know Assistant Chief Chad Wamsley, Chief Symington attends those, but that's actually an upcoming meeting and one that I will ultimately have with Dr. Farmer and try to understand exactly what their vision for the board. And then to that comment about telling the story, I'd like to know exactly what she's talking about representing the board, because we've got Catherine Murphy in the external affairs and communications manager role. So if it's simply messaging, we can do that. But if there is a specific message, you know, I'd like to know more before I set something in motion that's not what they're looking for.
Some in the community have a perception that the PSCRB has lost a little bit of momentum after its initial formation and initial round of work. What's your perception?
I don't agree, actually. I think the stakeholders in the community are very much aware of the PSCRB and how it functions. I think it has credibility in the community. You know, if we're at a point, you know, a couple of years into this, you know, 4 years into this, that we need to, I'm not going to say rebrand, but just bring it back top of mind. Maybe that's in part what Dr. Farmer's talking about and telling the story. But I do think that it has high credibility in the community, and I think it is a well-known entity to seek out if there are issues with the Bloomington Police Department.
Is it performing its mission of safeguarding that process and helping police continue to be credible?
I definitely think so. You know, other communities have this. When I came into this position now 4 years ago, this was something that had just started, and it's rather progressive. You know, I commend the council that approved that. You know, I think it is the perfect bridge to be able to tell the rest of the story, you know, the resident, the complainant, and then on the police department side of it, and then having this third party, you know, take all of this and digest it and come up with recommendations. I think it works perfectly.
It's Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason speaking with Charlie Schlenker. The mayors and city managers of Bloomington and Normal join us once a month on Sound Ideas.
When Britain turned control of Hong Kong over to China in 1997, children born that year were told they'd be the leaders of tomorrow. 25 years later, some of them are disillusioned.
We know that hope is important, but at the same time, it could be toxic.
That conversation, plus the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Listen Saturday morning between 7 and 10 on 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
With a few simple commands, you can access everything WGLT has to offer on your smart speaker. Tell Alexa or Google to play NPR or ask for WGLT by name. You can also take a ride on our 24/7 music stream, Highway 309. Tap into your smart speaker. Learn more at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A new state law will require public universities and community colleges to develop and implement equity plans with the goal to close gaps and expand access. Ginger Ostro is executive director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, which sponsored the measure recently signed into law by the governor. In this interview with WGLT student reporter Zach Zoller, Ostro says it will create better opportunities for underrepresented students.
Is part of the state's new strategic plan for higher education. We were focused on what it's going to take to close the equity gaps that we see in the state. So we identified a set of strategies in the strategic plan, and equity plans were one of those key strategies to help each institution identify the policies and practices that it has on its campus that may create barriers, and to identify those and address them so that we can close equity gaps. The legislation helps create the momentum to be able to do that at a statewide and systemic level.
Do you know how the equity plans will help address these gaps at the institutions and enhance outcomes for those underrepresented students?
Each institution will really look at its own data, evaluating its own practices and identifying the root causes of these gaps and what the barriers are, and then changing the practices, changing the policies, and removing any barriers so that they can close the gaps. It's important that it's individual to each campus because the challenges that students face are different on each campus. So that'll be each institution evaluating its own specific circumstances.
Can you describe the importance of equity plans in education and the impact this bill would have?
At its core, it really focused on the challenges that we see in equity. So it was grounded in data, and we just see significant gaps in the rate at which institutions enroll and graduate African Americans compared to white students, and Latinx students compared to white students. So significant gaps there. And we also see significant gaps when we look at it from an income lens between the rate at which institutions enroll and complete low-income students compared to non-low-income students. And so at its core, the new plan focuses on closing these equity gaps. The legislation is a big and really important step forward in reducing these outcomes, these gaps, because it requires each institution to do its own equity plan and address what we've seen in the data and in the practices across the state.
Do you know if any universities or community colleges in Illinois already have equity plans in place?
Yes, we're very fortunate to be building on work that was launched several years ago by a nonprofit organization in Chicago that has been leading work. And I think it's about 20 institutions, universities, public and private universities, and community colleges have already developed equity plans. So we're fortunate to be able to build on the work that's already been done in many institutions in the state.
From some of the ones already in place, could you provide any examples of root causes at certain institutions and actions taken place to improve those gaps?
I think we see very different things at different institutions, but there might be certain courses that students have different experiences in. So you really have to look at that very detailed level of what the students are experiencing and address the barriers. It might be that students need additional supports, additional advising supports to help make sure they're staying on track with their coursework, enrolling in the right courses to complete. So those are just some examples of the kinds of things that we see institutions do to better support students and address the equity gaps.
And then for some of the schools that already have these plans in place, do you know if any will already be meeting the obligation or if further steps will need to be taken based on the individual institution?
Well, really what we're looking at is doing this at a statewide and systemic scale to make sure that all of our institutions are thinking about and focusing on equity and addressing the needs of their students. And so this is a plan that's not static. It's a set of practices, and why we describe it as equity plans and practices, because it's ongoing work to make sure that we're continuing to meet student needs and help support them all the way through to completion.
And what will the Illinois Board of Higher Education's role be in helping implement these equity plans?
Our goal is to work collaboratively to design what goes in the plan. But again, it's going to be different and specific to each institution so that they can begin to build and implement the practices that are going to best support their students on campus. So we see this as work that's launching now, but is ongoing until we see these equity gaps disappear.
Was there any other concluding thoughts or any other information that you would like to share about House Bill 5464?
We really see and believe that it's important for Illinois' economy to thrive that we have educational equity. We just believe that educational equity and Illinois' economic growth are inseparable. And that's why this work is so important.
That was Ginger Ostro, Executive Director of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, speaking with student reporter Zach Zoller. State lawmakers have also passed two other bills to address equity gaps and expand access to higher education. One of them requires public universities and community colleges to assign benefits navigators for students. The other allows the state treasurer to increase college savings deposit amounts for children from financially insecure households. This is Sound Ideas.
This is WGLT reporter Lindsay Jones. There's a lot to cover in Bloomington Normal and McLean County. Local governments, a growing economy, a thriving arts scene, and more. Hear all of it weekdays during Morning Edition, or read and listen to those stories now at WGLT.org.
To help you celebrate America's independence, WGLT is offering bonus miles on Highway 309. Between Morning Edition and All Things Considered on July 4th, you'll hear our eclectic music format for six glorious hours.
Glorious.
On Highway 309, you never know what's around the next music bend, but we guarantee it will be good. Tell your smart speaker to play Highway 309 by name or stream it 24/7 at WGLT.org.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A new exhibition at the McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington looks back on the life and work of a prominent local artist. Sarah Nardi has more.
Harold Boyd is an artist who has been unafraid in his lifetime to look unflinchingly at bodies in decline. His figures age, if not gracefully, then honestly. The inevitable process of aging viewed through the lens of levity and acceptance. Now in his 80s, the artist and former Illinois State University professor has entered his own state of decline. Boyd suffers from Alzheimer's, and he now requires round-the-clock care in a residential facility. The disease has created an inescapable financial reality. Even with insurance, Boyd's healthcare costs are astronomical. His partner, artist Rhea Edge, has arranged for an exhibition of Boyd's work that will function as part retrospective, part call to action. The hope is that sales of Boyd's work can help alleviate some of the financial pressure of his care. Harold Boyd, Unforgotten, is running now through July 12th at the McLean County Arts Center in downtown Bloomington. Doug Johnson is the executive director and a longtime friend of Boyd.
Harold Boyd is really a marvel.
Johnson has known Boyd for 35 years and says he's in awe of Boyd's skill as a draftsman and the facile ease of Boyd's drawings. But Johnson acknowledges the dissonance between the quality of Boyd's body of work and the public attention it's received.
Just phenomenal, thoughtful, reflective, brilliant understatement with his work. But he didn't have an active exhibition record that someone of his facility would have and should have probably had.
Boyd's partner Edge says that for most of his life, Boyd chose to spend his time in dialogue with his work rather than actively promoting and exhibiting it.
He was a very private artist. He did not often invite a lot of people to his studio. He kept to himself a lot. He spent a great majority of his life making art, making work.
As a result, Edge says Boyd led a fairly isolated existence.
And in the last maybe 10 years, he realized that, and he wanted to get his work out. He wanted people to see it because he wanted to share what he learned and his own vision, his own personal journey with it.
Johnson says Boyd's journey involved an ongoing examination of what it is to be mortal.
The frailty of the human form was always part of his dialogue, but it was always created with such empathy. You know, it was always with a deep personal understanding.
In that way, Johnson says, Boyd's work has evolved from pure metaphor to stark reality. There's a certain poignancy in that, Johnson says, and one that has always been reflected in Boyd's art.
His work, I think, for all of us, changes dramatically as we spend time with it. I mean, I think that's one of the great strengths of his work.
In preparing for the exhibition, Edge combed through the entire arc of Boyd's work. Curating the pieces that would represent a body of work that spanned decades was an emotional journey, she says.
It tends to take you back through your life, through all its stages, and you connect with both your personal memories, your feelings, and your care and appreciation for the person, the artist that was Harold Boyd, that is Harold Boyd. But you also connect with what it's like to be an artist.
And Boyd's life is a poignant representation of what it's so often like to be an artist. Far removed from the glamorized idea of flashy galleries and blue chip sales, the life of an artist is often a cloistered, quiet existence, a lifetime spent in the solitude of one's studio in devotion to the work. Those lives, those artists, don't always garner the recognition or retrospective they deserve. Boyd is among them, says Johnson.
You know, I think this is an artist that merits that sort of investigation and would have so deserved those sort of accolades earlier.
But Johnson, who's an artist himself, cautions against seeing any artist as a tragic figure.
It's hard to make a living as an artist. Gosh, it's easy to make a life.
For Datebook, I'm Sarah Nardi.
Harold Boyd, Unforgotten, runs through July 12th at the McLean County Arts Center in downtown Bloomington. Sales and donations will go toward covering Boyd's mounting medical expenses. Beluga Press Art Gallery, also in downtown Bloomington, will feature an exhibition of Boyd's smaller works through July 15th, and that exhibition opens tonight.
Support for arts and culture programming on WGLT comes from PNC Financial Services, committed to supporting an all-inclusive culture and to doing right by the community they serve.
Thanks for choosing WGLT's Sound Ideas today, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Ryan Denham, and we had story help today from Charlie Schlenker, Zach Zoller, and Sarah Nardi. The show was produced by Samantha Hill. You can find all our Sound Ideas interviews and stories at WGLT.org, and that's where you can subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or NPR One. And we want to know what you think of the show, so comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter or Instagram, we're at WGLT News. This is WGLT Normal, a public service of Illinois State University.